Welcome to another episode of Commander and Coffee, where we pore over the details of the CEDH format. That was very cool of me.
I like that one. This isn't your daddy's French press. I actually really like that one, Jared. That was good.
I wish you didn't. Okay. Well, anyway, we have not just three of us back. Welcome back, Chris. No, you're not Chris. Who are you?
Cypher.
You just said, come on, you're the ball. Oh my god.
Can we just use our actual names? What is the point of not using our actual names?
Because the gamer tags tax give evasion. You significance in
tax evasion.
No, the gamer tags give you significance.
Whatever you say is null and void, it's tax evasion.
Alright, cool. Tax evasion. Sounds good.
We are using it for tax evasion, Mr. Accountant there.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm a basement hermit.
Sheesh.
A vertical basement. Yeah, a basement.
Isn't a vertical basement just an attic?
Yeah, but it doesn't sound as degenerate.
Ah.
We're talking about Winota. Very cool. So yeah, we had two people last week. Welcome back, Cypher. We are not only going to three people this week, but we have the addition of a fourth. Welcome to our first guest, Shady.
He's our resident Boros expert. He kind of picked up the deck and ran with it. Definitely a bit of a fan. His Winona deck is both a sight to see. It's definitely a deck that requires heavy duty sunglasses inside to be wearing, all foiled out, all pimped out to the highest level. So it's a very sick deck, really great pilot, really excited to have you on the podcast here to talk about Winona today.
Thanks, I appreciate it. I love the deck. I've been playing it. I started playing it before Strixhaven came out, but when that set was spoiled, that's when I was on. When, you know, Blade Historian, the creature that gives all attacking creatures double strike, and Rionya was spoiled, that immediately put me onto the deck.
Yeah, because initially when I first met you, you were more playing Urza, so a mono blue like control stacks deck. So you kind of only just, you know, you shift it from controlling aspects in the on the stack sense to controlling aspects into, well, life total number one, because player removal is one of the best forms of removal, and also just staxing people out with, you know, other things that you just put into play and go, stop me.
Yeah, exactly. One of the really cool things about Winota is when you put a creature into play, as soon as the trigger resolves, no one can respond to it. So if you put a Magus of the Moon into play and turn all non-basics in the mountains, well, if you have fetch lands, you're out of luck, right?
Yeah, it's like a pseudo, like, you better do this now or else you're going to stop, because, like, I might be having that Magus come down and people are going to be very upset.
Right, yeah, people need to know how to play around the deck. If you don't play around the Winota triggers, you will just lose to a Winota trigger. That's like a really, really cool aspect of the deck.
Yeah, so, I mean, from what I can tell is Winota is very, very commander-centric. What would be, like, something that your primary game plan, obviously the goal of the deck is to just kill somebody, but any other type of, like, intricacies with that? Or you want to give us a little detail of some of the goals and different strategies?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Well, Winota is an aggressive stacks deck. And you generally try and leverage two effects to kill your opponents, you know, besides combat damage. The two stacks effects that you're trying to leverage are Rule of Law and Thalia effects. Rule of Law stops a lot in the meta right now with all the Gnaws decks running around, and Thalia also stops the Gnaws decks. So just innately, by putting Winota triggers onto the board and getting your Winota triggers, you can put a Rule of Law effect and multiple Thalia effects into play and just grind the game to a halt.
Because you have a lot of redundancy in both effects throughout the deck, right?
Yes. You have multiple Rule of Law effects, you know, like you have Rule of Law, you have Aether Sworn Canonist, you have Deafening Silence, you have a lot of Rule of Law effects, Archon of Emeria is another one, and you also have the Thalia effects. You have your Glow Rider, your Vryn Wingmare, you know, your Thalia, of course, your Thorn of Amethyst. You're trying to put multiple of those effects onto the board and make it so no one else can play Magic. You're trying to land an early Winota with your enablers and relevant stacks effects, and you're just trying to break parity, and you just snowball the game in your favor.
In an average game for you, you're casting Winota, immediately going to combat and getting some kind of triggers to start that snowball, like you mentioned.
Yes.
About on average, what does that first Winota turn look like to you? Like, how many creatures are you expecting to have in play at that time?
Usually the amount is anywhere between 1 and 3. 3 is obviously like, oh lord, like, it's great. Sometimes you can get 4. That's if you're extremely lucky. A lot of people, when they first pick up the deck, the first thing they want to do is cast Winota. Usually newer pilots to the CEDH community, they want to just cast Winota as fast as possible. But you don't want to do that. You want to lead with your enablers first, then cast your Winota and get your triggers. You don't want Winota sitting around. Gilded Drake exists. Other effects exist. You know, Swords to Plowshares exists. Things like that really screw you up. So you want to land an early Winota with enablers, usually between 1 and 3. 2 is like on average. Usually it's 2. But between 1 and 3 is the answer.
The neat thing that I like about the deck looking into Winona overall is I think everybody can agree, and I'm sure we'll talk about this in a second, but one of the biggest hindrances of the Boros color pie is there's not a lot of good card advantage, card draw into the deck list, right? You're not slamming fishes and studies and, you know, having to do all of that that something like a blue deck can do. But just the fact that Winona literally gives you both like brainstorm / dark ritual effect, in the sense that you get to just like find a human and just put it into play for free is just insanely powerful into what she can do. It definitely is one of the only Boros commanders that like really caught my eye when it was spoiled. You know, usually I see things like Feather and Cole and I'm like, that whatever, I don't care, they don't mean anything to me. But yeah, this one's something that makes you go, wait, that does what now?
Yeah, that's actually a point of interest in the deck, is that a lot of the times when I play Winota, people don't realize how many, you know, things are actually stapled to that card, right? Normal Boros decks are starved on one aspect or another. Like you said, card advantage is the big one. This just gives you card advantage for free, so you can get card advantage off your commander and still cast spells. And it's just powerful, man. It puts things into play, it attacks, it puts stacks effects into play, and it just pushes out big damage. The fact that it digs 6 cards and puts something into play attacking, and not only that, it gives the thing indestructible. Like, why did they put that on the card? Why does it need to have indestructible too, right? It just does so much. It is incredibly commander-centric, as Cork said. If your Winota gets blown out of the water, you're kind of sitting there for a little bit, but when it gets going, it's really hard to stop.
This deck to me is always like, for those listeners that are looking to get into CDH, it's a little bit different than that. But if you're coming over from Legacy, this is like the like death and taxes of Legacy to me. Just low cost, cheap, efficient creatures that just do some things, only just trying to juggle the human to non-human ratios, which I'm sure we'll get into in a little bit later on down the line. But overall, like every time Winona triggers are going off, I'm just like, oh great, what's in the box today? And you know, what's coming out? And then just all the taxing effects and cheap and powerful creatures that we talked about, like the Thalias, the Vern Wingmares, and all that ilk just gumming up the game. But for those more established CDH players, typically, you know, the format is derived by how quickly the deck kinds to, you know, pop off or go off or sort of combo off here. So what would you say kind of like the speed and power level of this deck? Is this like a turn 1, turn 2 deck? Is this like a turn 3-4 deck, turn 7-8 deck? Where do you think this deck will fall under the spectrum of combo turn, quote unquote, basis for CDH?
You're always trying to get a Winota trigger by turn 3, but you're trying to win the game around turn 6. I would say around the turn 6 range. You have to play this deck very greedy, and you have to play it fast and just try and get as many stacks pieces onto the board as possible to slow down the Gnawz players, because Gnawz is so fast, right?
Yeah, are you trying to answer the Gnawz, or are you just trying to concede the game that like I'll let the table deal with the Gnawz and then I'm gonna come in off the back end on top of them?
You just sort of let the table deal with the Gnawz, but the thing is that Winota just puts so many things into play that are relevant against Gnawz that the Gnawz player generally has a very hard time, you know, casting a Gnawz. Like, let's say they cast their Gnawz, and it's gonna be later on, because early in the game you're trying to set up your stacks effects, like your Thalias and things like that. They cast the Gnawz, now they're under a rule of law on 2 Thalias. Like, what do you do under that? You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's definitely not something that as a Gnawz player, I'm actively excited to see these stacks pieces come down early on to start kind of taxing out the game. And again, they're so important to the game plan too. And I'm assuming not only just for the Nahs, but just to kind of break parity on what everybody else is doing while they're you know, casting their mana dorks and their other setting up their initial game plan. You're trying to slow them down and prevent them as much as possible because you're not really interacting that well.
You're interacting passively. You're not really interacting actively. The only time you really interact is to, you have a couple options for interaction, which I'm sure we'll get to later, but generally you want to stop things that are stopping your Winota from happening. Once your Winota happens and you get triggers onto the stack and you start putting things into play, it becomes very, very difficult to deal with it. There's even built-in board wipe protection, and you just put a ton of power into play with a bunch of stacks effects, like I've already said a million times. So
so a question that I had, and I really wanted to pick your brain on this one, as in my least favorite step, as our listeners know, is the combat step. It's an irrelevant step that means absolutely nothing for me. It's just a pass through phases. But for you, it's very important, right? It's the primary game plan. When you're hitting off of Winona triggers, you know, one of the things that I always look at is, where are you sending your damage? How do you typically assess where the damage is going when you're triggering these Winonas and flipping stuff over?
Generally, pod composition is the main thing, right? Nahs players are obviously high priority because you want to get their life total low for the Nahs. Generally, anything below 20 is good. Then you want to shift to people who I say can abuse their life on the board. So something like a Sylvan Library or if they have this out, you probably just swing into it first, but like a Treasonous Ogre, things of that nature. People that are abusing life currently and Nahs players are the primary concern. Also, Quirk would disagree, but I think the Shorokai deck is also a high priority target as well because of Humility.
If someone has a Treasonous Ogre down, like, they probably already won, I'm not going to lie to you.
Well, if there's a Treasonous Ogre down, I'm swinging at the Treasonous Ogre.
Yeah, no,
let me just put it that way. Yeah.
So diversify, but kind of your standard hierarchy of hit this, then this, then this, then this, so on and so forth.
So a lot of knowledge goes into the deck, like your opponent's decks. Like, you got to have a very well-versed, you know, okay, I know what, you know, I'm looking at a Tana Timna list or a Tana Thrasios list, and I think I know what that's in, or a Thrasios Timna list, and okay, this could be on XYZ. Do I have to worry about that? So, like, obviously, there's the obvious ones. You look across and you see like a Grixis shell, and you're like, all right, cool, I know what this is doing, you know. Yeah. But then there's other ones that could kind of throw a little bit of a curveball at you, with depending on what it is. So,
yeah, right. And like, another thing that commonly happens in games is when I land Sanctum Prelate, which says when it comes down, you name a number, non-creature spells with that number, with a CMC equal to that number cannot be cast. Depending on pod composition and like what you're playing against, especially in tournament, because people just bring wild left field stuff to a tournament, it really influences the number you choose. Like, by default, you choose 2, but if there's a player in the pod that, unfortunately, it happens in CEDH tournaments, people bring their, you know, high power deck, and they're like, oh, my deck is so powerful. They go to a CDH tournament and have a little slice of humble pie. They're generally running like a lot of wraths on 4. So sometimes you want to name 4. That's the two main things about this deck in terms of pilot skill are game knowledge and format knowledge and mulligans.
In the pods that I've played that included Winota, one of the strengths that it seems to have on just the game as a whole is that it really affects the play patterns of really common decks. Like Timna decks, for instance, they can't just be swinging out trying to hit 3 opponents and drawing 3 cards every combat. They have to consider blocking now. They're not really going all in. They are now the defender. A Najila deck, depending on how fast you get set up with Winota, they may have to be the defender. So you have all these other proactive decks that have to switch their plan A to compensate for just a Winota being in their pod, having that threat of, like you were saying, like the snowballing out of control. And then on the opposite end of things, if you're playing a fast Nauseam deck, they're kind of pressured to go off as soon as they can, or else get buried in Thalia effects and Rule of Laws, which affects a lot of other things, right? If you're going for a fast combo, it's not as consistent. So sometimes just the threat of Winota is just as great as the resulting board state that it eventually makes.
Oh, I agree. I agree with that statement 100%. I was going to say one of my favorite things about Winona in the pod, depending on the composition, is if like, you know, if you and Cork are on like two Thrasios mid-range decks, you know, I'm on Rograk Silas and Shady's on Winona. Now, like, the interesting context is like, so you have a deck that wants to cast Ad Nauseam and end the game quickly, but then you also have this Winona threat that's going to snowball out of control. So, you know, you mulligan to a hand that has Swords to Plowshares in it. Well, do you keep that knowing, you know, that slows down the Winona deck, but I don't have answers for the Nas deck? Or, you know, it's a deck that wins on turn 6 and turn 7, but it wholeheartedly kind of locks out the game, I would say, by like, you know, turn 3, turn 4 there, where it's just, it doesn't really matter what you do at that point. The game's so far gone from normal Magic at that point, right? Like,
you have the similarities to a normal stacks deck where the game can functionally end before life totals drop to zero.
Exactly. So like, you just don't, what do you do? Right. You have to be aggressive some of the times in your, depending on pod composition in your Winona mulligans, which I think is interesting and cool.
Yeah. That's actually one of the things that attracts me to Winona a lot is the fact that it is at its very core, it is a stacks deck. And that is extremely interesting because I love stacks decks that revolve around different aspects and attack it, you know, pun totally intended because it's coming from me, on a different format, on a different level than just like, you know, my baby is Derevi. Like, okay, cool. I'm going to tutor out my things. I'm going to control it that way. Whereas Winota's like, I'm going to swing at you and I don't care what happens. I'm putting this onto the field.
Of note, Winona probably very rarely swings. I could be wrong on this, but I've never seen Winona go into combat. Usually it's...
Oh, no.
I do. I put Winona into combat sometimes.
Oh, it turns her sideways. See, that's the expert level stuff. I would just be like, nah, this thing's an enchantment. Or toughness.
Depending on what you hit, right? There's always someone in the pod. Like, that's why Tim is so powerful, right? There's always someone that's open, and... You know, the only creatures that people are flashing in this format are like Aven Mind Sensor, Opposition Agent. You're not going to get got by a 4/4. So, well, I'm not going to say never because things can happen, right? But generally speaking, you can just get free damage. You always want to like try and maximize your damage because one turn of not getting damage in can lose you the game. All it takes is a deluge. That's all it takes. It's a toxic deluge or some kind of board wipe, and you can just be out of the game.
It can be a really good translation. Either going to or from playing a burn deck or like Naya Zoo in Modern, where you're trying to maximize your combat step as much as you can, because removal is inevitable in some way, shape, or form in a given game. So right. What can you do to set yourself up for success, knowing that people have these cards in their decks, right? So what can you do to maximize it? What can you do to prepare for a second wave of creatures after a board wipe potentially?
Well, sometimes you don't want to play out all of your Winota enablers. Generally, you do, but depending on pod composition, once again, pod composition goes into a lot of these decisions. Sometimes you want to hold a couple back, especially ones that aren't too powerful at the time. But generally, you just want to do your thing with Winota. There's a couple built-in pieces of Winota board wipe protection that we can talk about later that you can play. But generally, you're just sort of... I don't want to say you're all in, but you're kind of all in. You're just kind of all in on the Winota plan. And passively, the Thalia effects really do, like, if you put, you know, two Thalia effects into play, either by casting them or putting them into play with Winota triggers, you know, your 4-mana board wipe's now 6. And that becomes difficult, right? So do you board wipe and pass the turn? Or do you wait until later? There's a lot of choices. And one thing that Y mentioned is that Winota completely changes the way the game is played. So let's say you put in two Thalia effects. Now your 4-mana board wipe is 6-mana. And now you have to consider, do I just like board wipe and pass the turn and just give it to the combo player? It completely changes everything. So sometimes people wait on the board wipes. And if you wait on the board wipes, you know, Winota just gets out of hand. So that, I think that's why it's so powerful. You can't just give someone else the game by board wiping. It's different in two-headed where you can just board wipe away because you have a partner. But landing a board wipe at the right time is how you beat the deck. But if you do it when someone next to you is like on blue farm, you can just lose.
Yeah, one of my absolute favorite things about playing stacks decks is the fact that you, as a stacks player, and especially at one that you, you know, you regularly play stacks, and you know, unlike Cypher over there and thinks that it's the worst thing in the world because he felt bad because he locked the game out, but that's besides the point. You tend to always like to rely on either A, your fellow stacks player at the table, or B, the innate stacks that people tend to play, and then C is the control aspects that your other opponents are playing. Whereas in my mind, when I see a win node at a table and I'm the stacks player, I'm like, all right, cool. I don't have to prioritize my Thalia effects. I don't have to prioritize my, you know, one spell a turn effects. I could prioritize my other type of effects. So in Shorokai, for instance, when I was playing that, it's not really a stacks deck. It's more of a control deck, but like my blind obediences and my humilities become my main priority to get to. Because that A affects the Winota player very well in this case, but it also does not, it tends to hurt the other players at the table as well. One of the other things that I noticed when playing against, you know, Shady's Winota and other Winotas is how very little interaction it has at instant speed. It's pretty much you play on your own term, kind of like Hearthstone related. There ain't much thing that's going on anywhere else.
I'm glad you would noticed.
Of course, why wouldn't I would notice that?
So, generally, actually, I really like going against stacks decks with Winota, except for Shorokai, because, you know, humility is a real beater. Humility is a real beater, and if it continues to be a force in the meta with Shorokai and Jessica Ishii, then we're going to have to play more answers in the instant and sorcery slot. But the more instants and sorceries, it's kind of the bane of the deck. The more instants and sorceries you put into the deck, the less powerful it becomes. Because now you're hitting less enablers, you're getting less off of your triggers, you might miss some more. So that's a downside to the deck. But the deck does piggyback off of other stacks very well. Like, I remember I was playing in a tournament, just a normal CEDH tournament. Someone played a Sphere of Resistance, and I, like, jumped for joy. I'm like, I don't care. I just put everything into play. And I ended up winning that game off of the Sphere because no one
Welcome
could do
to how much that I love playing stacks. When you see somebody else play a stacks deck and they go and they drop a Winter Orb, you're like, oh, I love you. I will make love to you right now at this table.
Yeah, right? Right? Exactly. Exactly. And the
like Full Metal Alchemist where they're fighting Sloth.
Yes, yeah. That's actually exactly what came to my mind, but I didn't want to say it because I didn't know if anybody else would get it.
we have the gamers and the anime watchers in chat.
Rise up, gaming.
So, we talked a lot about pod composition and different decks and stuff like that. So, just a quick overview, Shady. What are you excited to sit down against, and what type of decks are you sitting down against? Going, oh, this is going to be a slog.
Anything Gnaws, immediately love. I love my Gnaws players. Gnaws players are great, but not too many of them. Not too many of them. If there's too many of them, they start doing weird politics things, which I'm not a fan of, but I like a Gnaws player. I like another stacks player that isn't Shorokai. Shorokai is probably the deck's worst matchup. But generally, like, if there was a Derevi in the pod, yeah, I'm jumping for joy. I mean, Core can testify. I was in a game with him, and he put a Stasis Lock onto the field, and I was like, I'm going to make a token every turn. You know, normal stacks, I really like. And Gnaws, fast combo. Anything fast combo, I like.
What about something in the middle, like a Thrasios midrange?
Hey, I hate that. I actually don't like going against Thrasios midrange because the Thrasios midrange player draws a bunch of cards and they're playing midrange. And now that the meta is swapping back to more creature focused, they're playing more removal effects. They're playing, you know, their Toxic Deluge and things of that nature. So midrange decks, I don't like to see. They're generally the ones with answers. And the meta, even though it's going back that way, currently the meta is still very greedy, in my opinion. And when Winota's at the table and everyone's being greedy, Winota tends to outgreed everybody.
I just imagine like all the Gnaws players sitting around a table, just like looking at each other, licking their lips, going, we're going to take out that Winota faster.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that does happen sometimes. And usually one of them removes the wrong piece and throws the game. That is one of the downfalls of stacks.
Hashtag never forget.
If you're playing against non-experienced CEDH players in general, they see a Winter Orb, right? Like, they're getting into the format. They see a Winter Orb, they want the Winter Orb gone because it's hindering their gameplay. But they don't really take into what else is going on at the table. So Winota plays better into pods with experienced CEDH players that know, like, hey, if this Aethersworn Canonist isn't here, that Gnaw's player is going to draw 40 cards. You know what I mean?
I would say that playing against Winota, or, you know, having a Winota in your pods is a good way to, in my opinion, learn the format. It gets you in that mindset of being able to see the big picture, seeing that entire house of cards on that kind of threat assessment, the Rube Goldberg machine that you are usually a very big part of.
Right.
We could even call it the Queen's Gambit.
Oh my God.
We can't just call things other things all the time, Cork.
Why not? Listen, everything is something, even when it's not something.
You lose the source material. You have to show respect, pay homage.
We are something different than our names.
No, I'm Y.
Why are you Y?
And this is Commander and Coffee, the podcast where we are, yes.
I love that you're shilling mid-podcast. This is fantastic.
and thanks, I'm all out of coffee.
We already have it. Thank you guys for listening. You're already here. I will say though, I do love the point. As a Gnaw's player, myself, I will stand on my soapbox and I will die on my sword that we get a bad rap for always being like the most hated players in the game because we're trying to win the game on turn one and ruin everybody else's fun. And you know, there's only so much fun in a game and we try and take it all. But that being the case, I really like that Winona exists because, like I said earlier, it creates this interesting, I feel like as people get better at the game, where it's like, yeah, all right, it's simple. I'm going to mulligan to like Force of Will because I need to counter the Gnaw's and then I could play Magic. It's like, well, yeah, but there's a Winona at the table. So you can absolutely shit kick my face in and remove me from the game. And that's fine. You do that. But then Winona is just going to snowball out of control and you're going to sit here for 40 minutes and lose the game. So it really teaches, it helps to teach people that there is more than just, you know, counter the Gnaw's and that Magic's an easy game.
Well, I was just going to say, like, Winota has about like two dozen draft commons that, you know, you would look past in a normal context, but here they are, you know, killing you.
Yo, what up? Here's my Goldhound to the face.
Here's my Alcide of Life's Bounty, even though it's an uncommon. Actually, is it a common?
I think it's an uncommon.
Speaking of draft commons, Shady, looking at your list versus the other lists on the primer, what are some big differences or some swaps that you find you like a little better than some of the other ones? I got a couple I'll talk about, but I wanted to hear your thoughts first.
Right. Well, first I think we should go over the different deck variations in general. There's three versions out right now. Well, mine's just a derivative of Avalanche, which is a Kiki-less version that's trying to hit face as hard as possible. But there's three versions out right now. There's the Winota Snowball Stacks, which, of course, is created by Comedian MTG. And he's the one who actually gave this deck a chance and started this whole trend of Winota. And I actually met him in tournament, and I played against him, and I trick-binded him, and he laughed it off. I thought he was a cool dude, and that's how I found this deck, was by... I watched one of his videos on the deck, and I'm like, oh, that's sweet. And then Strixhaven came out, and yada yada, the rest is history. So there's a Snowball Stacks version. There's Avalanche, which, like I said, is Kiki-less. You're trying to beat face. And then there's this other one. I don't know what to call it. I mean, it's just called Winota Stacks, but they're all Winota Stacks decks. I guess I'm going to call it Winota Resilience Stacks, because it's running more recursion effects and running different effects.
Yeah, from what I saw when I was comparing them myself when I thought about building this was the Winota Stacks one, quote unquote, the one that's just called that, is more of just, hey, I'm going to persist throughout the game. I'm going to not try and just go balls to the wall. I'm going to persist. I'm going to be here and it's me. I'm here. You know what I mean? And it's trying to win on a whole, it's like the you know, a different axis than the axis that Winota's already on. And personally, wasn't the biggest fan of it. I was actually more inclined when I wanted to build it was more of an Avalanche style.
I think it's very interesting because the Winota Stacks version attacks a different angle that the Winota Snowball Stacks and Avalanche version don't attack, which is Enter the Battlefield triggers. They're running things like Kotli Honor Guard and Hushbringer to stop Enter the Battlefield triggers, which we like to use in the other versions, so I think that's a really cool angle to attack. It's also a Null Rod, which, I mean, hey, it's Null Rod. Null Rod is powerful, right? It's running more instants and sorceries as well. Well, actually, the same amount of sorceries if you count double-faced cards, but it's running more instants and more instant speed interaction, which is also another really interesting take.
I'd like to focus a little bit on the Winota Snowball Stacks list really quick, because first of all, of the three of them, it's the best name for an IPA. And secondly, I think that this kind of demonstrates, because this is the fewest diverse cards from your list, Shady, and I think it kind of shows like the Kiki package, just like by itself. This is the Kiki package. If you want to play the Kiki Jiki line, we see, well, obviously the Kiki Jiki, but also a Mog Catcher, Thalia's Lancers, Zealous Conscripts. Yeah, I don't know. This is a couple cards, right? So what's your take on it? Why have you abandoned the Goblin Shaman?
The Goblin Shaman does give you a bit more resilience. There's also Village Bellringer, which Ian took out, but Kiki Jiki gives you more resilience. But as I was playing the deck, because I was just playing, I'm not going to lie, I was just bone stock playing Ian's version. Because Ian was a cool dude, and the deck just looked really solid. So I was playing Ian's version for a little bit, and I noticed when I was playing it and just jamming games, because Court can testify, when I first started playing this deck, I just jammed the hell out of it. And I noticed 9 out of 10 games, I just wasn't playing Kiki. I wasn't doing the Kiki combo. I usually was just winning off of combat damage because the deck just puts so much power into play. So the Avalanche version and my version want to put more damage into play versus putting a Kiki into play. So you have a trade-off there of more damage versus more resilience. I prefer putting more damage into play because the deck is kind of innately all in already, but that's just my personal take. There's a lot of different opinions on this.
I mean, I firmly believe that almost every deck has like that, you know, oh, this is the, you know, tried and true method, but there are some derivatives of it. I know in my Derevi list personally, like a lot of them go for like the Wizard Ball strategy, but I personally don't like it. It all comes down to personal preference. At the end of the day, almost every deck you play has to have your own personal flair for it so you can enjoy it. You know, I mean, by and large, yeah, the decks are as they are, but a lot of it is because of their personal preference. Like I know, for instance, you're running things like Lena and Selfless Spirit to kind of protect yourself from those board wipes. The other thing that I thought was really interesting about your deck and versus a couple of the other ones is you're running Grand Abolisher and they're not. That seems like a interesting choice on really both ends. I understand that, you know, you don't want your opponents to do things, but you're not truly a combo deck, so that makes it a little interesting as to why you're running it over them.
We'll move to Lena in a little bit. That's a whole separate conversation. But Grand Abolisher in general, normally it's to protect the Kiki combo, but I found out a lot of the ways that I get blown out of the water is beginning a combat, remove Winota. That's what gets me. And if I put a Grand Abolisher into play, they can remove Winota at the beginning or at the end of their turn. But when it comes to my turn, I can recast it and go to combat. I've just found that to be invaluable.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense there.
As per Selfless Spirit, I've had a lot of success with it. There's a lot of, where I play generally, there's a lot of Fiery Covenants and Pyroclasm effects, and Selfless Spirit just fills the void, you know? It's a Winota beater that says, sack it, creatures you control gain indestructible. Like, what's better than that? And as per Lena, that's something that I saw a while ago. I didn't want to test it, but the Winota Discord was testing Mirage Phalanx at the time, which we basically phased out at this point, because we think it's not very impactful in the 6-mana slot. And I saw Lena, and I'm like, I'm going to give this a shot. I put it in the deck, and it just does a lot for the deck. So I'm going to read Lena off really quick for those who don't know, because it's a little bit of an obscure card. It's a 6-mana, 4/2 white, to 3/3. Legendary creature, Human Knight. When Lena, Selfless Champion, enters the battlefield, create a 1/1 white soldier creature token for each non-token creature you control. Sacrifice Lena. Creatures you control with power less than Lena's power gain indestructible until end of the turn. It's a 3/3. Most of your enablers are either 2/1s, 2/2s, or 1/1s, right? So you give all your enablers indestructible. But the really crazy thing is that it does the same. It sort of fills the same role as like a Mirage Phalanx, because we'll get to the combo lines later. But Mirage Phalanx basically put an onboard threat that you had to answer. The 1/1 white soldiers, notably, they're soldiers, they're not humans, right? So it just puts, like, on average, around 5 Winota triggers that must be answered that also has board wipe protection. So if Lena hits the field, you can just blow the game out of the water very easily. Very, very easily. And it having the board wipe protection as well is sort of icing on the cake. It's very resilient. I like it a lot. It also has a neat little interaction with another card that I'm running called Gold Knight Commander, which whenever another creature enters the battlefield under my control, all creatures I control get +1/+1 in, until end of turn. It's happened where I put a Gold Knight Commander into play and then flip Lena for 10, right? And just pump all my stuff +10/+10. It's insane.
It is its own snowball effect.
Yeah. If you flip a Lena, it's great. And another thing is that if you have a Lena in your hand and a bunch of mana and you get board wipe late game, you can just, you know, play a creature, play a creature, play Lena, and then you're back to the races. Because now they have to answer your Winota or you're going to win, because you're going to put like four triggers into play just off of that, plus your other triggers, you know what I mean? So it has a lot of options in that, with in that aspect. But it being six mana is a little rough, I'm not going to lie. I'm still testing it. It's been doing really well. I was at a different two-headed giant tournament, and the one I went to, there's another Winota player that I recommended. I wanted to ask him about testing Lena, and he ended up testing Lena, and he's like, he came up to me like hype. He's like, oh man, I put 9 Winota triggers in the play, and they couldn't do anything. I'm like, yeah, when you put 9 Winota triggers in the play, it tends to like make it so you win the game on the spot, right? Unless you get board wiped, but Lena has that board wipe protection.
Now, I think every one of us here can agree. We talk about Magic a lot, almost as much as, you know, vegans and CrossFitters will tell you that they talk about that. When we talk about Magic, we're talking about cards that go into Winota. What's kind of like your checklist of is this going to be good for Winota? So the most recent example that I can think of is when we were having the conversation about Goldhound, actually.
Right. Yeah. Goldhound is an interesting one. Definitely an interesting one, because normally in that slot you would play something like Skirk Prospector. Like in the traditional Snowball Stacks list, you're on Skirk Prospector. The Skirk Prospector can sacrifice goblins, add the mana, cast Winota. It has a lot of versatility in that way, but with Goldhound, you're getting a artifact creature with First Strike and Menace, and you can sack it, add one mana of any color to your mana pool. The important thing is not only does it have First Strike and Menace, but it's an artifact, which normally is a bad thing because you have to worry about Dockside, but the deck plays in the Dockside well with Rule of Law effects and things like that. So it being an artifact means you can enable the powerhouse of this deck and the card that I cut Kiki Jiki for, Jorkadeen the Prevailer. It's 3, a red and a white. It has First Strike and Metalcraft. Creatures you control get +3/+0 as long as you control 3 or more artifacts. And you're flipping other things into play like Rick's Steadfast Leader and Blade Historian, things that give double strikes. So now imagine you're putting, you know, you have your 1/1s that are 4/1s double, 4/1 double strike. How do you defend against that in this meta? You don't. You just die. So I feel like Goldhound helps enable that versus the Skirk Prospector. I'm currently on Goldhound. I want to find a slot for Skirk Prospector. I think it's incredibly powerful. And it's really cool because a lot of these choices between the different deck creators in general, a lot of them are really unique, really cool, and can see a lot of success.
So what is your golden ratio, per se, of humans and non-humans? What would you think that would be?
You generally want more non-humans. I would say 45% humans to 55% non-humans, because with Winota looking 6 cards deep, you know, there's only so many humans. You can put one human in the play for each trigger, and you need enablers. You need enablers. You need enablers. If you don't have enablers, you generally don't keep the hand. And if you know, you can just flip into the pieces that you need. You can find the pieces later. So generally, it's 45 to 55. Now, the Snowball Stacks version is playing 23 humans and 29 non-humans. And they're playing 44.2% humans to non-humans. Avalanche is 24 humans, 28 non-humans. And it's playing 46.2% human to non-humans. Same with Winota Stacks, the new list. It's the same thing as Avalanche. And my list is closer to Snowball Stacks, where I'm playing 23 humans, 29 non-humans. And the percentage is 44.2%. human to non-human. So you generally want to be within that golden ratio of 45 to 55, I would say.
do those numbers and those calculations include the man lands, the Blink and Ink Moth Nexus that are in the deck?
Oh, no, it does not, actually. You are correct. So it should be an additional 2 per one. Sometimes it's or 2 non-humans. Generally, the Ink Moth Nexus comes into play when you're already set up. Same with Blink Moth. I was just counting the creatures in general, but there are 2 man lands. Generally, the ones that are played are Ink Moth and Blink Moth Nexus, or Blink Moth Nexus and Urza's Saga. The reason why Ink Moth Nexus gets cut is because it doesn't do combat damage, right? It does infect damage. But Urza's Saga is one that I need to test. I need to put some work into testing that, because it seems like a really interesting option. It can do a lot for the deck. It can make you Winota attackers. I mean, generally, you're not doing that. You're trying to progress your board. But in a pinch, it can make Winota attackers. It can also, you know, just put a Gingerbrute in the play or a Jeweled Lotus in the play. I think that's extremely powerful. So I do want to test that out. I haven't gotten to it yet, but I will be doing that swap over soon. But yes, it's generally 2 man lands. So technically, it's 31 humans to 23, or 31 non-humans to 23 humans. A couple Winota lists I've seen have taken the man lands out. That's still up for debate, but the primer ones generally are on 2. Good point. Thanks for bringing that up.
And I feel like that's kind of a dynamic conversation as more cards get spoiled, because some things are just good enough to make that one card concession one way or the other.
Right. And something else. So the Avalanche version is also playing humans that make Winota triggers. And my version, like Lena, you know what I mean? And another important one is Brea's Apprentice, which is a 3-mana 2/3 that enters the battlefield, makes a Thopter. It has other effects, but that's generally the most important thing. That, and it's an artifact, so it enables Jorkadeen really easily. But as more humans come into play or get spoiled that make Winota triggers, that ratio can change, right? So if there's like more 2-drop humans that do that, like you have a Loyal Apprentice, which is a 2/1 with haste. At the beginning of combat, if you have Winota, you make a 1/1 Thopter with haste. Like, if you get more creatures like that, of course the ratio will change and swing more to the human side than the non-human. But as it stands right now, I like the ratio where it's at right now at that 45-55%.
There is the, you know, this is Magic, this is Variance land. Sometimes you just whiff a lot, you know, hit a land clump, hit, you know, anything like that. And that's why I think, like, when you were talking earlier, the idea of not running as many instances and sorceries really comes into play. It basically just makes sure, it helps you ensure that you are going to get what you need and when you need it.
Right. I completely agree. There was a time even yesterday when I was playing and I missed 3 Winota triggers in a row. Even with my deck being on 52 creatures, I still missed 3 Winota triggers, even though I have 23 of them in the deck. So it just happens, and as long as we can reduce that variance, the better the deck becomes.
One thing I wanted to appreciate with a high-level Winota play, because I've played with you in Two-Headed Shady, something I've noticed that is a line for an experienced Winota pilot. Sometimes you get the opposite of finding nothing, and that's where you find everything. You're flipping 5 very good humans in 1 Winota trigger. You only get 1 into play, the rest go on to bottom. So doing things like holding on to your tutors, not cracking your fetch land until the second main phase, those things matter a lot, because in between Winota triggers, you can be shuffling, and that might put strong targets from the bottom of your deck and redistribute them before further triggers.
Yeah, right. Well, when you normally hit 5 humans, it's usually pretty sad. You normally want like 2 or maybe 3 options. But when you hit 5, you know, you do end up putting a lot of powerful options to the bottom of the library. And yeah, you are correct. Sometimes waiting to fetch until later to shuffle those options back into your deck, or at the end of that trigger in response to the next trigger, can help you hit those humans and get that power onto the board.
Nice. I like that. It's. I love the aspect of the axes that Winota literally attacks on. It's such a unique thing that is... It tickles that part of my brain that goes, yeah, this is cool. This is very cool. I have most of the cards for, aside from like Rick and stuff like that. I just don't. I'm like, why? Because the mirror match is absolutely garbage. I hate playing it. I hate watching it, actually, more than just playing against it.
Oh,
I've
God.
Had multiple in my pod at the same time while I'm on a different list, and it is the worst. you know, it's kind of like a standoff. They're both kind of shuffling around each other the entire time. It's just, you know, it's terrifying.
It becomes a one-on-one game at that point. It becomes whoever lands the Winota and gets the triggers onto the board first generally wins the game. Unless someone has a board wipe to switch things up, that's generally how it goes. Because they're all playing the same stacks effects. If I'm going into a Winota heavy meta, or a meta like Two-Headed Giant, where you need your attackers to get through, I generally play the card Cavalry Pegasus to give all humans flying until end of turn to just get more damage in and, you know, break parity on the creatures being on the board. But I do like the Avalanche version putting more power into play. It makes the mirror matches a lot easier, but they are awful. I hate playing the mirror. The mirror is my least favorite thing to play. It's just, it becomes less skill-based and more, can I get a fast Winota? Can I out Winota then? You know what I mean? It changes the dynamic completely. I know it's a little hypocritical, but I'll play against a Winota playing something else. The mirror match isn't fun. And like you said, it completely just sort of saps the fun from the pod, in my opinion. Like, if there's two Winotas at the pod and you're like the Nos deck, it's like, all right, well, I just lose. You know what I mean?
So we've definitely talked about, you know, some of your interesting choices in the list. Are there any notable exclusions aside from the obvious ones like the Skirk and the Kiki, you know, stuff like that? How about anything else that seems like a very good include that a lot of other people are running but you aren't, for whether it be personal choices or, you know, maybe you just hate the card?
Well, I don't hate any of the exclusions. A lot of the exclusions in this deck are valid options. That's like the really cool thing about this deck. Like, I'm not a fan of Esper Sentinel personally. I don't hate it. It's good. It's a great card. And it's an artifact, so you think it would be an automatic include. But it being a human sometimes, it not triggering Winota, it can smooth out slower draws. But if you're on a fast draw and you're trying to go, you know, Roger, Ornithopter, one drop, or Mana Rock, you know, like trying to just put a lot of Winota triggers into play, and you're like, oh, Esper Sentinel. You know what I mean? Sometimes you just wish it was another trigger. So currently I'm not on Esper Sentinel. It's something I might switch back to. Every time I've played it, it's been a little lackluster. But, you know, it's a valid option. Other people are having success with it. So I'm personally not on it. Cliffside Rescuers, another really cool one. It's a great card. There's a lot of board wipes in the area, though. So I'm on Selfless Spirit instead of that. Rescuer, you can sack it and give target creature protection from the color of your choice until end of turn. So board wipes in our particular meta, in our particular area, go down a little bit more, especially the damage-based ones. I will go to Cliffside Rescuer. I'm not on Skirk Prospector, like I said. I'm on Goldhound right now because of the Jorkadeen and the built-in evasion. I'm off Kiki combo, and I'm off the Blast. That's a controversial one, the Blast. Pyroblast and Red Elemental Blast. Because I'm on Path and Swords, and the reason being is that, like, Drenith Magistrate is huge against this deck. If you can land an early Magistrate, this deck just sort of can't play. And you need to out the Magistrate. And Path and Swords can out it, and Blast cannot. And if you're playing Winota, and you're playing behind curves, so if you're trying to play, like, Winota plus Protection to protect with a Blast, you're already behind. Because you need with this deck, like other Stacks decks, Cork, you need to put Stacks effects onto the board as fast as possible to slow everyone else down, and then you can play your own game. But if you're holding up a Blast and not putting things onto the board, then you're opening yourself up for a bad time. Normally, I play one of the Blasts. I play Red Elemental Blast instead of Pyroblast because of the redirection aspect that Pyroblast does have. But currently, I have it cut out, and I haven't really been missing it. Another thing is Wear Tear. You can play Wear Tear. I have it as a flex slot for Humility. If more Humility sticks around, then I'm going to have to be on Wear Tear because my current option to destroy artifacts, well, there's a few of them, or enchantments, I mean. Enchantments, there's one of them, but there's a few for artifacts. But you have Cathar Commando, where you can sacrifice it to destroy an artifact or enchantment. The issue is that, like, if Humility is on the board, you play your Cathar Commando, it's a 1-1 with no ability. Generally, Wear Tear, I utilize as a flex slot for that. And then we have good old-fashioned...
What's it do? We'll try and help you out. Sounds like two words.
Oh, okay. I'm off of PNLR and PNKarenLR.
There you go.
Yeah, I couldn't remember Nalar for some reason. I remembered Pia. I couldn't remember Nalar. But the Avalanche version generally wants to put Winota triggers into play off of Winota triggers, but PNLR and PNKarenLR. PNKarenLR, you know, if I was to go back to one, that would be the one that I would play because it has a shock effect to it and it puts two Winota triggers into play. PNLR is a little lackluster. It only puts one in this a three drop, but the reason why I cut PNKarenLR was Facebreaker came out. I like that Facebreaker gives card advantage, and currently I have PNKarenLR out of the deck because the four CMC conflicts with Winota, you know, existing in the command zone. But it is good to flip in. I'm probably going to go back to that one. I'm off of Braid right now. It's great, but it being two mana with all the Thalia effects is rough. That's like another thing I didn't even mention, actually, is that a lot of the Thalia effects make your interaction, your instant speed interaction, a lot worse. So things on two, like it was discussed a lot earlier, the Flame Scroll Celebrant, the one that's also a silence, people are off it because a two mana silence is just rough. If it's a four mana silence, you know, you're just giving up almost your entire turn to cast a silence, which you need to progress your board, right? And it being four mana, two white pips is sometimes a little bit much, especially if there's another relevant stacks effect in your hand that you need to play to stop someone else from winning. Gorilla Shaman's another one that I'm off that could easily see play. Easily see play. It just being able to blow up mana rocks for one mana is, especially like Mana Crypts and Mox Diamonds and Chrome Moxes and Lotus Petals and Treasures for one mana is very powerful, but In the turns that you want to be using that card, it seems to conflict with, once again, the Winota plan, where you want to cast Winota on four, so you can't really afford to be paying mana into the Gorilla Shaman to blow these things up. But in a heavy artifact meta, like if you're playing in a pod with like Urza, Ovar, and Magda, you might want to be on Gorilla Shaman, right? So that's another really cool aspect with this deck, is how versatile it is with the answers that you can run, but it's one that I'm not currently playing.
So, question.
Yeah.
With the way that your list is running, would you say that you're more or less living in the Winoment?
Yes, I would say that. I would also say that that's an awful pun.
Has there been any consideration, and I'm genuinely curious about this, and I keep wanting to force these into more decks than I probably should, but it is what it is. From opposing Winona Pilot myself, the standard play pattern is move to combat. While you're in combat, I'm doomblading the crap out of Winona, right? I'm removing that creature from the board, right? That's like combating against the deck 101, right? Just kill the damn Winona, and then it's a Goldmer attacking you. I don't care about that.
Yeah.
Has there ever been any consideration or thought process on including White's one-time blink effects like Ephemerates or Cloud Shifts or anything like that to kind of act as pseudo protection to the deck list? I could be too slow. I just didn't know if that was ever a thought to like help kind of, you know, keep the Winona around.
Yeah, one that was considered for me personally was Ephemerate. Ephemerate was one. Eerie Interlude was another one. And also, gosh, what was the other one? Guardian of Faith, I believe it's called. Let me just double check that name really quick. But it came out from one of the D&D sets. Wow, I got that right. Cool. Very obscure card. But things like that do help. But once again, it falls into the same camp as the Red Blast and why I'm not currently playing those. And it's that if you're playing a Winota and you're holding up like three mana for an Eerie Interlude, which might be like four mana, by the way, because of like a Thalia effect, or you just have a Rule Law effect in play and it's dead, you can't really afford that. You just need to just sort of stick to your game plan and just gun for it.
Makes sense. Like I said, I was just curious because I always thought like, you know, having that one-time blink effect just kind of because again, I know you do, but I would just like, I don't care if my Winona needs to get in. I care about my non-creatures more. So, and Winona is usually the target for removal like that. So
yeah, right. I try and mitigate against that with like passive effects that do the same thing. Like Grand Abolisher, like I said earlier, Grand Abolisher being in the play to make it so you can't remove Winota in combat. That's one that I'm just, people have cut it. I really like it for that reason, because the play pattern, like you said, is go to combat, remove Winota. Now Winota's not getting triggers. If Winota's gone and I go to my turn, I just go, yeah, I'm going to play Winota and you can't do anything about it. And I'm going to go to combat. You just have to sit and wait and see what happens. I think that's incredibly powerful. Incredibly, incredibly powerful.
All right, guys. So with that being the case, let's take a break for a second here and let's move on to our coffee break and kind of talk about what we're drinking today.
Welcome to another episode of Coffee. My name is Y.
And I'm Cork.
And I'm not doing this.
I'm Shady.
And this is Coffee.
I still refuse. I'm Johnny.
I'm already Tracer.
I'm already Tracer.
Nerf Bastion.
Nerf Bastion.
So yeah, Shady and I took a trip up to Grateful Roast this morning. We barely beat a parade on the way out. We were able to race it on the side street and get in front. So, but before that,
they were on foot. It was amazing. You should have seen
it. Yeah, it was great. Well, we took someone else there for the first time. And Shady, what did you recommend?
I got the Nola. It's a New Orleans cold brew. They take their Kyoto cold drip and they put brown sugar and some kind of root extract. Do you remember what the root extract was called?
Yeah, it was chicory root.
Chicory root, yes. They put chicory root in it. It creates a really unique, like, rooty, earthy flavor that, paired with the brown sugar, it's not too sweet. It's very well balanced. Paired with the slight sweetness of the brown sugar, creates, like, a really unique, like, almost root beer-esque drink. Not root beer as in, like, super sugary and sweet, but more well balanced. Very refreshing.
If I remember correctly, that also uses oat milk in there, correct?
Oh, yes, it does use oat milk. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was busy playing softball this morning in this extreme heat that we have up here and dying, so I had them grab me a Kyoto cold drip because that is probably one of my favorite ones. They use their house blend on that, and it's borderline tea, and it's so good.
Yeah, it really does taste like tea.
Hashtag not sponsored.
And against my better judgment, I went with the siphon coffee because I just really wanted a hot coffee today. I don't know. We drank it on site, so I wasn't too worried about having it in a hot car. But I usually like letting the dealer choose. I just say surprise me. And they gave me an Ethiopian blend. And I rarely have black coffee. I usually stick to oat milk and things like that. But I kind of just went with it this time, and I'm really glad I did. I think everyone should have that reset every now and then and just have their coffee black. It was nice and bright. Like a lot of Ethiopian coffees, it was really fruity and had a lot of aromatics to it. So, yeah, a lot of diverse choices today, but it was well worth the trip.
I've been drinking some tea, actually, lately. I've had my fair share of green and chamomile teas lately, trying to, again, get back into the groove of things in my real life. So that's been fun.
What? You're drinking some other water? Hold on. This is groundbreaking, ladies and gentlemen. Hold up. You are drinking something other than water?
Yeah, I know, right?
It's herbed water.
To be fair, tea is just dirty water, so.
I mean, if we're going down that route, Dr. Pepper is just spicy barbecue sauce.
I mean, yeah. Have you ever had Dr. Pepper barbecue sauce?
Yeah. By the way, it's not sponsored. No.
My personal favorite way to use Dr. Pepper, and it's the actually only way I'll have Dr. Pepper, is in ham, with like roasting a ham with Dr. Pepper, and I turn it into like a glaze. Yeah.
Barbecue sauce is just Dr. Pepper yogurt.
True. you are correct. You know, I was going to make a Walter White joke with you talking about the siphon coffee, and then you said, my dealer chooses the coffee, and I went, oh, okay, well, that's just going to tell itself.
We got there.
I mean, we yeah, kind of. Yeah.
All right. Well, that was our coffee break.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Cork.
Stop it. Back to the episode.
Welcome back to another episode of Commander.
Our Winoma is over.
Now that we've kind of talked a little bit about the deck, about the different variations, let's move on to mulligans. So as in typical fashion, I'll read off a couple of cards. You guys can tell me whether we're keeping or mulling, and we'll do a couple hands like this.
My mulligan guide is to look at Shady and be like, do we keep it?
I actually really like this hand.
Yeah, this hand's insane.
Starting out, we have an Igunjo, Seat of the Empire, an Enlightened Tutor, Bloodstained Mire, Ginger Brute, Mana Crypt, Ornithopter, and a Deafening Silence.
Normally, I would say keep as a 5-card hand, You know, before you said the Ornithopter and Deafening Silence, this is a windmill slam keep. You have your Mana Crypt. Any hand with Mana Crypt is generally just insane in the deck. The fact that you can put two triggers into play on turn one off of the Mana Crypt and a Deafening Silence is huge. The Enlightened Tutor can also fetch a Rule of Law later, which is something else that's relevant. Usually Enlightened Tutor plays the role of a second Mana Crypt, but you can fetch the Rule of Law, you have the Mana Crypt, you have two Winota triggers on turn two, and a Deafening Silence to stop Gnaw's decks. This hand is insane. It's great. I would snap keep it.
Yeah, there we go.
I was going to say, like, this is a turn two Winona with two triggers, and you're starting the turn out with a Deafening Silence. So if you're, like, on the play, this is stupid.
Hey, everyone. Cork here. We had a little bit of technical difficulty and lost a lot of our hands that we were working with. So I'm here with Shady again.
Hey, I'm back again a week later.
And we are going to go over a couple more starting hands with everybody here. Cypher and Y are both busy at the moment, so it's just Shady and I. So we're going to take this a little quickly and get you some hands because we know how much you guys love them. So our first hand today has Gemstone Caverns, Selfless Spirit, Combat Celebrant, Hope of Gearper, Shatterskull Smashing, a Mountain, and Athalia, Guardian of Thraben. What do you think, Shady? I mean, I have my initial thought, but I'm going to hold it off for you.
Okay, well, first thing I want to say is that this is definitely a going second hand. You do not want to be going first with this hand. If you're going first with this hand, I would immediately ship it back. But going second, it gets a little bit more interesting. You have three turns to draw another land. I would keep this going second. Going first, I'd ship it back.
Going first, absolutely ship it back. That's an understatement. I do agree with you. Going second, third, fourth, I would love it. What's your pitch to Gemstone is the real question. My thought first is actually the Selfless Spirit. I'd rather do that because I'd rather keep the Shattersoul Smashing as my third land because, again, I can then just jam out the Combat Celebrant, the Thalia. I could turn one the Thalia. I could play the Combat Celebrant turn one if I wanted to, but I'd rather the Thalia, honestly, to slow everybody down a little bit.
So, funny enough, my pitch would actually be the Combat Celebrant. The Combat Celebrant being a combo piece, that is relevant, but this deck isn't trying the combo, it just sort of stumbles into it. It's like, oh no, whoops, I comboed, right? So my turn one looks a little bit like, I'm turn one-ing Thalia every single time.
Oh yeah,
Thalia's back-breaking super early in the game.
Yeah, especially if you're going second, absolutely.
Yeah, the cool thing is that since we have Hope of Gearper, turn two, we can get two Winota triggers on board, because we'll have three mana at that point.
So here's a question. Is there actually merit? No, I miscounted my mana. Yeah, turn two would be playing Hope and Selfless Spirit then if you pitch the Combat Celebrant.
Yeah, the Combat Celebrant's a little bit clunky here. I'd rather have two Winota triggers on the board, putting more pressure. And the Selfless Spirit giving protection as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's pretty useful. And both triggers have evasion, so...
Yeah, can't beat that.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do another one.
Next hand, first seven, we have Lotus Petal, Chrome Mox, Prismatic Vista, Scalding Tarn, Thorn of Amethyst, Simeon Spirit Guide, and City of Traders. Shady, what do you think?
My first instinct is obviously ship this back, but there's some really funny merit here to to going Lotus Petal, City of Traders into Thorn, and then maybe... No, we just ship this back. This is funny. This is really funny. Literally, if there was another non-land card in here to pitch to the Chrome Mox, there's some merit to keeping it, actually. There's some merit, but I think we can do better.
So, I mean, I guess if you absolutely wanted to keep it, would the play not be Lotus Petal, Scalding Tarn, Chrome Mox, pitch the Simeon Spirit Guide under it, and then play a turn one Thorn of Amethyst after your Chrome Mox and Lotus Petal are down already?
So, that was my first thought, which is why I was thinking about shipping this hand at first, and then I was like, actually, you know what? Simeon Spirit Guide is a trigger, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I would rather have the trigger on board than, you know, putting it under something, because you don't know if you're going to draw into another one, right? There are more non-humans in the deck than humans, but the problem is that you just might not draw another one. I would ship this hand back, but I just thought it was an interesting conversation to have, which is why I wanted to.
Yeah, and I'm 100% on board with shipping this. You know, I do kind of see where it could be more of a trap hand than anything else.
It is. It is. That's why I wanted to talk about it.
Yeah. All right, let's see our next seven. We have a Plains, a Windswept Heath, another Plains, a Sunbaked Canyon, a Brea's Apprentice, a Soul Ring, and a Sarah Ascendant.
See, this is really interesting because we have the Sarah Ascendant and the Soul Ring both on one, and the Brea's Apprentice for a trigger. Funny enough, since we're on our first seven here.
Second seven.
Oh, this is our second seven? Mm-hmm.
So are you pitching this and going to six? Or
I might pitch this.
Okay.
I think I'm going to pitch this because the Sarah Ascendant and Soul Ring are both conflicting on one.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to get the Brea's Apprentice out. So you're looking at a turn three Winota with one trigger. I think you can just do better.
That's fair. I personally would actually keep this one on the back of the turn one Sarah Ascendant into the turn two Brea's Apprentice because you're going to drop two lands off there.
Yeah.
So we said pitch, I said keep. We'll go with you. You're the expert here.
Yeah, I mean, I'll pitch it.
Go ahead. Go to the next one.
So I'm on six.
Yeah, you're on six here. Here's your six. We have Thalia, Guardian of Thraben, Simeon, Spirit Guide, Mana Vault, Shatterskull Smashing, Rionya, Fire Dancer, Dockside Extortionist, and the Red-White Painland, which I can't read the name.
Yeah, it's the Secret Lair one for you guys who don't know. Battlefield Forge.
Oh, okay. Dockside Extortionist and Battlefield Forge. Now, remember, you're on six here, Shady.
I am on six. If I do keep, Rionya goes back in the deck for sure.
100%.
So let's say Rionya's back in the deck. I have the Dockside and the Simeon. Oh, this is a tough one. This is another hand that really is showing, like, you need to really look at pod composition.
Right.
Because if the pod composition is heavy artifact, we keep this. For sure. For sure. Just having Dockside on one, like, especially if, like, we're going last, that's another thing to take into account.
Mm-hmm.
Dockside does get us a trigger.
I mean, you are also, it does have a turn one Thalia, which we did say, if you're going in the early turns, it's kind of backbreaking.
Yeah, we do have the turn one Thalia as well. I think we keep this.
I definitely would keep this personally.
I would keep this over five. I do like this more than the last hand, unless there was a Nos player at the table. Well, no, we have Thalia. What am I talking about? Yeah, I just like this hand more.
Absolutely. All right, let's get a fresh seven in here.
Sure, it sounds good.
Fresh seven just brewed up. Thorn of Amethyst, Spirit of the Labyrinth, Rin Wingmare, Ancient Tomb, Hope of Gearper, Prismatic Vista, and Recruiter of the Guard.
You know, this is a hand. You always have those hands where you're in tournament, and you're like, I'll risk it for the biscuit. This is one I would risk for the biscuit. I'm not going to lie. Just because of the amount of backbreaking stacks we have in our hand, starting off with the Ancient Tomb for acceleration.
Mm-hmm.
So turn one, we just go Tomb, Thorn. Turn two, you play the Vryn Wingmare. That alone is like backbreaking for a majority of the decks out there. Now, if there's like a Silvala and like a Yisan in the pod, we don't keep this hand. But man,
yeah, but anything that casts spells is pretty much having two mana on having to pay two extra mana for everything. It's pretty rough.
Yeah, and let's say we don't draw the land, right? We still get a Spirit of the Labyrinth out or a Recruiter of the Guard to go fetch Solitude, which we could pitch to Spirit of the Labyrinth, or we could use Recruiter of the Guard to go get, you know, one of our mana rocks like Ornithopter of Paradise, our mana creatures.
I mean, this hand literally just screams, I'm playing stacks, and that's my game plan.
I'm going to draw into that land. Yeah, it's going to happen.
it's the beautiful thing about Winota and being able to pivot so well into like the full-blown stacks deck or to be that avalanche deck.
Yeah, yeah. This is a keep. I'll keep this.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, what do we say for one more?
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right, next seven up here, we have Plains, Needle Verge Pathway, Rin Wingmare, Amiria's Call, Swords to Plowshares, Archivist of Ogma, and Mother of Runes. It feels like a trap. I mean, I just have, you know, Admiral Akbar screaming in my head going, it's a trap! The entire time while I'm looking at this.
Yeah, so this is one of the hands that an inexperienced pilot of the deck will pick up and go to their local game store for like a CEDH tournament type deal, which are happening more and more, funny enough. They'll go, they'll sit down, oh, Winota's cheap to build. Let's sit down and play this. And they see this, they go, oh, this is a keepable hand. It has three lands and four spells and some removal and some protection. It's everything you want. But in actuality, it's just too slow. Like, you're not, you can play the Mother on one, the Archivist on two, the Ridden Wingmare on three. But by then, your opponents are trying to win the game, right? And your stacks piece isn't coming down until turn three.
Yeah, no, I mean, we mentioned pod composition a lot in our discussion. And this is really, it boils down to a pod composition hand. And also, not only that, power level composition. I think this is a perfectly acceptable hand to keep if it's in like a high powered environment. Where you're okay with taking, you know, to turn four, turn five, maybe six even, but in a full-blown, full-power CEDH pod, you know, or TEDH, depending on what you want to call it for tournament EDH, this is 100% a ship.
Cool. Let's go to our second seven.
Second seven. Plus, especially since you have a second seven coming, yeah, it's just free real estate.
Yep.
Okay. This one is interesting as well. You got a March Flats, a Deflecting Swat, Enlightened Tutor, Spectator Seating, Remorseful Cleric, Combat Celebrant, and Iganjo, Seat of the Empire.
So there is some upside to this hand. Enlightened Tutor in this deck is generally, you know, unless you're already established, is generally just a second copy of Mana Crypt.
Mm-hmm.
The problem that I have with this hand, and the reason why I would probably go to six in this situation,
mm-hmm.
is that you have nothing in your hand to take advantage of the Mana Crypt. And you only have one thing. So you have one Remorseful Cleric. You have the Remorseful Cleric the following turn. So you have to put yourself back a turn anyway.
Yeah, it's a turn three Winota. It's a turn three with one trigger only. You know, which by that point, you're hoping for two to three triggers.
Yeah, so I would ship this hand. I would go to six.
Absolutely. Let's hear it. Let's see it. All right, so our six is Simeon Spirit Guide, Cavern of Souls, Spectator Seating, Dockside Extortionist, Blink Moth Nexus, Phyrexian Revoker, and Cathar Commando.
So every time Dockside comes up in the conversation, wow, I'm going to say it again. You guys are going to get sick of hearing it, but pod composition? Gosh. A Dockside on one here that goes even is still, like, fine. You know what I mean? It's still it's still good. I would, on six, I'd probably ship the commando here.
Mm-hmm.
Because I like the prospect of drawing into like a soul ring or something for the revoker.
Mm-hmm.
I'd probably ship the commando. I'd keep the revoker. But the revoker and the commando are interchangeable because of that good old pod composition.
Mm-hmm. You know it, you love it, that pod comp.
So, if we ship the commando, we have Revoker, Blink Moth, Dockside, Spectator Seating, Cavern, and Simeon Spirit Guide. Simeon Spirit Guide can be... It's going to go into Dockside.
Okay.
And if Dockside's going even here, like if it's making two treasures, it's still a Winota on two with an attacker.
Okay.
Which I'm inclined to keep.
Okay. Now, is there merit here to turn one Phyrexian Revoker?
That's another pod comp thing. Mm-hmm. There is merit. Like, let's say someone throws down a Mana Vault. You know what really sucks under a stacks deck? A turn two ad nauseum.
Mm-hmm.
So there is merit to going turn one Revoker, turn two Dockside. But to be safe, I would probably, because I want Winota on two with an attacker. That's right. The game plan, right?
Right.
And if we go Revoker first, let's say they only play two artifacts or enchantments, we might not get there. So it just depends on what's in play. If there's like a lot of artifacts and enchantments in play, you turn one the Revoker. You just turn one it. Right. Because you can climb off of Dockside to Winota. being there if there's like four artifacts and enchantments in play. But if not, I probably, if there's only like two and it's heavy creatures for some reason, I probably turn one the dock side, then turn two the Winota with a trigger off of the cavern. Having cavern in this hand's a beating too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would keep this hand. Yeah. I would keep this hand. I do like the prospect of going turn one Revoker, turn two Dockside with a trigger.
Yeah.
But that's only if it happens, which it generally does. It's just, I'm going to pretend like it isn't.
Yeah. That's fair. That's fair. A lot of fast mana is being played. There are the few decks that don't run as many as, you know, other decks. But hey, I mean, everything happens for a reason, right? It is what it is. All
you
right.
You want to do another one?
We do one more because that was a little funny one. We'll do one more.
Sure. Sounds good. Sounds good.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Oh, actually, this one's okay. Final test hand here. We have Aben Mind Sensor, Sunbaked Canyon, Goblin Rabble Master, Bloodstained Mire, Spirit of the Labyrinth, Phyrexian Walker, Mana Vault.
So it's turn two Winota with a trigger. We do have the possibility for a second seven, but man, just having the Walker there changes the hand completely. And this is why the colorless enablers are so powerful, because that other hand that we had where we had the Soul Ring, we couldn't keep because we just had nothing to capitalize off of it. But this would be the same thing if the Walker wasn't here. If the Walker was not in this hand, we would ship this hand because we have the Mana Vault and nothing to capitalize off of it. But we have 100%. The Walker here. So I do like the different angles of attack that this hand gives. I like that you have the Mind Sensor to stop the searching, the Labyrinth to stop the card draw, and the Rabble Master to just beat face. We're obviously turn one-ing the Mana Vault with the Phyrexian Walker. This hand has a lot of upside. It also has a lot of downside if the Mana Vault gets countered.
Right. Yeah, if it gets mental misstepped, you're a little sad boy there.
I actually am leaning towards keeping this hand.
Yeah. No, I can definitely see the merit in that.
It's a turn two Winota with a trigger. Or if you get into another mana rock, you could literally go, like, let's say you draw a crypt or something. Well, if you draw a crypt, this hand's just insane because Goblin Rabble Master is probably the best enabler in the deck.
Right. And Legion Warboss?
Yeah. Legion Warboss. Let's say you draw, like, I don't know, a Chromox.
I mean, personally, yeah, I was going to say, personally, the amount of upside that you get with by keeping this and the potential for the upside far outweighs the downside. I mean, I think this is a safe seven.
Yeah.
If you want it to be a little more risky, you could definitely take a mulligan here because it is only your first seven.
I do like the fact that, let's say our Mana Vault gets countered, we have the potential to curve out on a really strong board.
Mm-hmm.
That's
why I think it's such a safe seven.
Yeah, I do like it. Like, here's the other cool thing. If we drew, like, a Chromox or something and a land, this is a hand where you could go, there's merit to going turn one Mana Vault, turn two Spirit of the Labyrinth, Goblin Rabble Master, and just going, you know?
Yeah.
Obviously,
Phyrexian Walker down,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, too, yeah, of course, you know. So, if we did that and we had a way to get to, like, to get the four on the next turn, you know, that's four triggers on turn three. That just wins you the game.
Yeah.
That'll just win you the game.
Digging 24 cards deep? Absolutely.
Yeah, like, if we draw a Lotus Petal, if we draw, like, any zero-drop rock, this hand's absolutely insane. There's a lot of upside with this hand and multiple angles with attack. I'm keeping this hand.
Yeah, like I said, I think this is a very safe hand to keep. It allows you to pivot. It allows you to just avalanche again. But also, if you kind of putter out for a half second, like, you're still okay because you're still applying pressure.
Yeah, we keep this.
All right, guys, that's going to do it for our redone opening hands today. So with that, thank you for your patience. Thank you for everything you guys do for us. We appreciate you, and I'm Cork.
And I'm Shady, and I'm all out of coffee.
See you later, guys.
Peace. Oh, I forgot to do the shout-outs.
Okay, I was literally about to click stop recording.
Okay, cool.
So, All right, hold on. I'll segue in. Hold on. You got any shout outs there that you're looking to do, Shady? Any special mentions? Anything you want to plug for us here?
Yeah, sure. Follow me in my Moxfield. It's oversized_shady. Oversized is one word in this case. Shout out to Comedian for introducing me to the deck via his YouTube channel. It's really cool, and he goes over a lot of stuff and different content for the deck. Shout out to the other Primer authors. You guys are doing great. Keep experimenting. Let's keep making the deck better. And just thank you for having me on. I really do appreciate it, guys.
Absolutely.
Cool.